Time was that people would talk about a decline in manners or politeness. Now they're more likely to express their concerns by talking about a civility crisis. But does the new language signal a different social climate or just a new way of complaining about it? Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has had his ear to the ground on this one.
Sometimes a change in the language reflects a change in the world. Sometimes just a change in the way we talk about it. And sometimes it isn't easy to tell. Take civility. It began its life as a word for citizenship and a close kin of civilization. But by the early 20th century, it had dwindled to a genteel term for a nominal courtesy or for perfunctory expressions of politeness, a word that transit companies posted on bus placards in those recurring campaigns aimed at getting riders and employees to be nicer to one another. Back then, people didn't actually talk about civility very much. They were much more likely to complain about bad manners, rudeness, or discourtesy. As late as the 1950s, the words civility and incivility were appearing in the New York Times only about 5 or 6 times a year. The words didn't take off until the 1960s. In 1969 alone, they appeared in the Times more often than they had over the entire 8-year Eisenhower presidency. And by now, they're 30 times more common in the media than they used to be. A lot of people would explain that sudden rise in civility talk as a direct response to a breakdown in public manners. In a public agenda poll a couple of years ago, 3/4 of the respondents said that Americans used to treat each other with more respect and courtesy in the past. But then every generation since Victorian times has had exactly the same impression. Etiquette writers in the 1920s railed about people who monopolized party lines, rude streetcar conductors, women who pushed you out of their way in department stores, hosts who invited you to dinner and then made you listen to their favorite radio programs, and of course the discourteous motorists who are classified as roadster rowdies, coupe cads, and van vandals. Manners are like the English language. It always seems as if things were going just fine until this new generation came along. But that changed in the 60s. To some people, the provocation of the social movements of the period seemed to go beyond mere breaches of decorum, and beyond anything that could be conveyed by old words like impolite, rude, and discourteous. So they reached back to reclaim the older meanings of civility and incivility, which invested personal deportment with a sense of civic and political consequence. In an editorial that appeared just before the 1968 elections, The Wall Street Journal inveighed against what it called the new incivility. As the journal described them, the culprits included the student protesters, the filthy hecklers who dogged the steps of presidential candidate Hubert Humphrey, and the enraged Negro spokesman who denied any virtue in white civilization. And the offense wasn't just in what all the hippies and protesters were saying, but in their disagreeable physical appearance. Their slovenly hair, beards, and clothing, and their general squalor, the journal said, showed their contempt for the world of decent manners. As philosophers and sociologists use the word, civility is something distinct from simple politeness. It's more like the attitudes and behavior that make our public discourse possible. But in the mouth of most modern critics, the power of civility and incivility lies precisely in blurring the lines between personal and private life. Incivility seems to draw everything that's coarse, irritating, or merely thoughtless in American daily life into a single deep rent in the nation's moral fabric. It's hard to think of any other social vice that covers as much ground as incivility does. Cell phone abuse, brusque store clerks, airlines that keep people sitting on the tarmac, telemarketers, reality TV, spam, road rage, shock jocks, and nightclub hecklers, not to mention congressional partisanship, attack ads, hostile bloggers, and belligerent talk show hosts. A recent book on incivility in the workplace uses the word for everything from overuse of the fax machine to the excessive use of email acronyms. There's clearly a lot to get worked up about out there, and incivility bundles it all up in a cognitively efficient package. The word by itself does a lot of the work of connecting the contentious tenor of political life to a general decline in personal values. Armed with the notion of incivility, critics can decry the routine crudeness of broadcast expletives, hip-hop lyrics, and gross-out movies like American Pie as the harbingers of imminent social and political disintegration. And on the other side, the word provides a pretext for writing off serious political speech in the same way we dismiss rudeness and intemperateness in everyday life. speaking disrespectfully of the president, say, becomes morally indistinguishable from saying nasty things about a coworker in the hall. In the course of things, the charge of incivility can close off serious discussion every bit as effectively as more traditional forms of rudeness can. What makes civility and incivility so elastic is that the words live out their entire existence on op-ed pages, with no grounding in the homey truths of everyday life. Parents don't teach their children about civility. They teach them about things like manners, respect, and politeness. Those are the real family values. A lot of the things that people describe as incivility would count as simple bad manners, but a number of them wouldn't. And you have to wonder whether the new cover term is a way of obscuring differences that we ought to be paying attention to.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of the book, Talking Right. If you'd like to catch up on interviews you've missed, you can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menjivar, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music by Willie T., the New Orleans pianist, singer, songwriter, and producer. He died Tuesday of complications of colon cancer. He wrote and arranged the music on the 1973 album The Wild Magnolias, which combined Mardi Gras music and funk. Here's a track from the follow-up 1974 album, They Call Us Wild, which he also produced.